Hello, everyone. Okay, so my title is Migrant Women's Experiences with Community Healthcare, a Holistic Examination of Barriers to Reproductive Healthcare for Chukis Women in Guam. And I have no relationships to disclose. Okay, the Pacific region of Micronesia has been the site of frequent colonial projects over the past four centuries, resulting in inconsistent and discontinuous development up to present day. Several of these islands in the region gained independence in 1986 through the Compact of Free Association with the United States. Subsequently, citizens from these newly independent nations were permitted to live and work in the U.S. with a unique status. They're actually called non-immigrants in the documents. Chuuk, representing one state of the Federated States of Micronesia, one of the nations created by the Compact, experiences significant transnational migration to the U.S., and particularly to the territory of Guam. Chuuk's poverty and poor infrastructure create an environment where migration to nearby Guam is necessary for those who want to maintain close proximity to Chuuk, but also obtain adequate health care, education, and jobs. Unfortunately, the Chukis have been the focus of negative reactions toward COFA migrants in Guam, rhetoric about Chukis only coming to give birth for U.S. citizenship, food stamps, and welfare is widespread, as is an association of all Micronesians as primitive and backwards, in contrast to modern and westernized local tomorrows. As part of a larger project which examined how Chukis women's reproduction is constructed and conceptualized by women, their families, and their home and host communities, I sought to learn about women's experiences with and barriers to receiving reproductive health care in Guam. My interest in this topic was inspired from the limited but concerning reproductive health data. Unfortunately, the deteriorating infrastructure in Chuuk and the neocolonial context of Guam inhibit regular data collection and analysis of standard reproductive health indicators. And those which are collected are often considered incomplete due to underreporting. Yet what we do know is that the major causes of death in the FSM include prematurity and complications related to pregnancy and labor. And the infant mortality rate is at least double of Guam's 12.7, which is about double of the U.S. Infant mortality rate. Women recognize the risk of birthing in Chuuk and make considerable efforts to get out of Chuuk to access safe health care. Yet in Guam, Chukis women are not always getting the health care they often migrate to receive. Haddock and colleagues found, for example, that while Micronesian women only represent 9% of women of childbearing age in Guam, they accounted for 54% of deliveries with no prenatal care. With regard to sexually transmitted infections in Guam, although Micronesians make up only 12% of the population, they account for 26% of new chlamydia cases, 28% of new gonorrhea cases, 27% of new HIV cases, and 43% of new syphilis cases, and that includes latent and infectious. Researchers often draw the conclusion from these limited data that a lack of healthcare seeking among migrants is the major contributor to poor outcomes. But these studies are largely quantitative and derived from secondary data, which leaves little room for understanding the context behind access and utilization issues with this group of women. So this multi-sided research project proceeded in two sites. I explored both the clinic and the community in order to holistically understand the environment in which reproductive health disparities among transnational migrant women emerge. It was important to study both Guam and Chuuk to examine how the transnational movement of women may contribute to their health disparities. So over the course of 2 years, I conducted participant observation in three publicly funded health clinics in Guam and one in Chuuk, semi-structured interviews with healthcare workers in both sites, to total 24, and reproductive life history interviews with 15 Chukis women, which were over the, there were several interviews since it was their whole life. So it was about 35, I think, interviews total. Findings triangulated from participant observation and interviews in both sites were analyzed to explore factors impacting Chukis migrant women's utilization of and access to quality, effective, and culturally competent sexual and reproductive health care. Today I'm going to focus on Guam's clinics. Okay, my observations were in the clinic. So I was working with women who eventually gained access to clinical services. However, they experienced many barriers to getting that access in the first place, which I realized I needed to focus on. So I'll begin with a review of these barriers, and then I will go on to quality care and confidentiality. So first, transportation. It was by far the most prominent barrier to care, described by both healthcare workers and Chukis women in Guam. Often a large family will have just one car, and it's driven by the wage earner. So while Guam does have a public transportation system technically, it's notorious for being unreliable and incredibly slow, which leaves no real options for getting around. And Guam is 12 miles by 36 miles, so it's not as small as it might seem on a map. It's not exactly easy to walk places. Provider availability is also a significant barrier to care. When there are not enough providers, the clinics tell patients to call back the following month for an appointment. The reproductive health area will turn away all reproductive health issues that are not prenatal care until they catch up, which didn't happen in the 8 months that I was in that particular clinic. Even pregnant women were sometimes told to call back in the next month. As Maria, one healthcare worker, explained, for Chuki's women, we do get like the third trimester where they're almost about to give birth, but I think it's mostly because we're scheduled so far ahead that they don't get a chance to come in early and because we have not that much provider. I mean, they would come in for a pregnancy test, but you don't get scheduled till a month after. Pregnancy tests are also very difficult to obtain in the clinic, which is the first necessary step to accessing the clinic for prenatal care. One is required to do a pregnancy test either there or at another clinic in order to get an appointment for prenatal care, yet only 2 to 3 patients can get a pregnancy test each day. So patients would come back several days in a row with their limited transportation options just to get a pregnancy test, just to get an appointment. Not understanding the healthcare system and its requirements was another factor that influenced women's ability to access reproductive healthcare. Nora told me about her cousin, for example. I was thinking, I have one cousin, she's pregnant, but I asked her, did you go check up? She said, no. I said, why? She said, because I don't know how. Another woman I interviewed turned my interview around on her. She started asking me questions when I asked if she had ever gotten a pap smear or STD testing, asking me how to go about doing so. She told me she had never been tested despite being in Guam for 10 years because she didn't know where to go, despite knowing that her partner had had many other partners outside of their relationship. The very concerning side of this is women who seek care too late and suffer great morbidity and mortality. This late care-seeking stems not only from a lack of knowledge of the system, but this combined with the overburdened system once they encounter once they do seek care, which often postpones treatment. Healthcare workers told me stories of women coming in for problems entirely too late and getting an appointment even later, some of whom presented with advanced cancer or other terminal conditions by the time they arrived. Scholars and healthcare workers I spoke with often suggested that education about the importance of prenatal and other preventative care is what they needed. However, back in Chuuk, women frequently seek prenatal care. They know how important it is. Thus, it's more confusion and fear of a confusing system and how to get that care, not whether it's important or not. These women's and healthcare worker stories inspire a call for more providers available to provide care, more referrals and assistance obtaining specific services available instead of just here you go, and not simple prevention education, which often perpetuates putting the blame on the patient as part of individual responsibility narratives. Another interesting aspect related to access is the fear of facing providers when patients do not follow through with their prescribed lab work or some other request. Women specifically told me that they missed appointments because they had not had the time or money to get their lab work completed. Women did not want to get scolded for not completing the task and preferred instead to stay home. Lab costs can be very high and prohibitive for these women, and the time and transportation required for lab work is also consuming in the midst of a very busy life. They either work extensive and often non-traditional jobs, low-wage jobs, and so non-traditional hours, or they take care of several women's children while they work. So there are wage earners within the family, and then anybody who's staying home is taking care of all the elders and the children. So they don't exactly have a lot of time to be running around and getting their own lab work done. Okay, once they actually get there. So barriers to quality care. Once they've gained entry into the clinic and secured an appointment, the issues change. They're more about language, the clinic, and so forth. Okay, language barriers. Language is considered the most profound barrier to quality of care by healthcare workers and patients once a patient is in the system. Healthcare workers and women alike discussed how difficult the language barrier can be, which impacts how much information is transmitted between healthcare workers and patients, whether patients actually understand the clinic process, how well they can fill out forms or make appointments, and their comfort level in the clinic. This also leaves many messages lost in translation, confused conversations between healthcare workers and patients who often both speak English as a second language, but different languages, and so they don't understand each other's accents, and a very concerning frequency of family interpreters controlling healthcare decisions. The second inhibitor to quality care is the feeling of the rush in the clinic. I found that a hysterical rush was a daily occurrence that stresses healthcare workers and patients alike. The providers were just trying to get through their patients fast enough to see them all, but oftentimes this compromised the treatment of the patients. As Jevlene noted, many patients identified a lack of providers and a long line of patients as reasons for the partial and unsatisfactory explanations of their physical ailments, which in turn made them too uncomfortable to ask questions. So this is what she said. They just need to really explain what they give us, you know? Because sometimes when they go there, they are just really fast because plenty patients. That's why they don't really explain. You know the time I went? We just go in there and just check, check, check. Okay, go out. Go to the other, you know? Not really sit down and, oh, like this, like this, like this. Didn't you see it, Sarah? It's really fast. And because only one doctor, we cannot talk long in there because they're worried about getting to all the patients, you know? Sometimes this was just the feeling of the rush. But in particular parts of the clinic, there was notable hostility toward the patients, and especially Chukyi's patients. The front areas were by far the most tension-filled areas of the clinic. The waiting room, patient paging system, and medical records rooms were hectic, confusing, and loud. And when patients got lost or confused, these front clerks scolded them for not listening. As one participant, Kayleen, told me, if you can just get past this front, you start getting treated like a human. So what made these clerks so negative? The patients I observed were gracious, polite, and quiet. The clerks, however, perceived them as bad patients who didn't follow the rules and caused the clinic to slow down. Throughout my interviews with the clerks, they told me of their frustrations with being overworked, with limited space, and the pressure and stress of trying to get the patients through the first step of the clinic process. Within this environment, there was often also this notion of patients trying to make things more difficult. A few clinic and hospital ethnographers have focused on the frontline workers and the ways in which they act as gatekeepers to care with a marked hostility toward patients. As Anderson argued, healthcare workers are often perceived as suffering from an attitude problem, but this idea of an attitude problem is simplistic and problematic, inherently reverting to this idea that biomedical encounters are actually objective, rational, and culture-free, and therefore these people are causing problems by bringing their culture to work. He argues that differential treatment should rather be understood as a form of agency within a complex institutional setting, characterized by understaffing, poor working conditions, and resource deficiencies. In this environment, this may be how the most powerless health workers are asserting their power to the only actors who have less power than them, the mostly migrant patient population. These health workers are often paid minimum wage. They're very close to needing the same services as the patients. Okay, the yes factor. The interactions between patients and healthcare workers are also inhibited by something that is prevalent within the Chukyi's community. The yes factor is the unbelievable politeness of Chukyi's women and their inclination to say yes to anything. This comes from an environment in which the public is not regarded as a space for creating or airing conflict, nor is the family, and people are expected to keep their negative feelings inside so as not to negatively impact the group. In the healthcare setting, being part of the clinic employee structure seems to automatically render all healthcare workers a higher status than patients, and thus Chukyi's patients act with great deference. This makes patients very unlikely to ask questions, and when they do, they are really nervous about it. Interestingly, this politeness has another element. Healthcare workers can never determine whether a patient will follow through with something that they're supposed to do, because they will always say, yes, I will do it, whether they plan to or not. Regarding cultural ideas influencing patient behaviors, much has been written about several migrant groups. Some work has demonstrated that API populations are shy, deferent, and uncomfortable discussing concerns with providers. But in fact, all minority populations, this has been considered as in terms of calls for cultural competency. What these characterizations and subsequent arguments often do, however, is perpetuate stereotypes about people and continue to blame the patient for their deferent and polite culture. I risk allowing for the same stereotypes by presenting this yes factor. Some researchers have determined that the power relationship created by the clinical encounter necessarily makes all types of patients relegated to an unequal position, therefore less likely to speak up. Just like many minority groups who have previously been connected to patient politeness and deference, as reflective of particular cultural values, Chuukyi's women likely have a more pronounced version of something that most patients of biomedicine share because of their vulnerability and powerlessness in the community as ethnic minorities. So it's like we're all kind of different to our physicians, but they're doubly different because of being in this vulnerable position. Perhaps the most interesting barrier to care is best illustrated by one clinic's decision to hire two Chuukyi staff members. This decision was made to improve interactions in the clinic, language issues, and it has been extremely helpful in some ways. The strange and paradoxical finding here is that it both hurt and helped access to the clinic. As expected, women with whom I spoke, both as they received services in the clinic and throughout the community, expressed great appreciation for one particular clinic hiring the staff. They felt more respected, safer, and they thought it would be easier for Chuukyi's patients to receive services. As one participant, Jasmine, said, "It's good if Chuukyi's working here too. Before, no Chuukyi's, we treated like nobody wants to help us." Yet at the same time, and often coming from the same women, was a desire to change clinics or avoid care specifically because there were other Chuukyi's women working there. There was a general consensus that Chuukyi's people do not respect the concept of confidentiality. Therefore, the patients do not want other Chuukyi's people becoming aware of their medical information. My conversation with Jasmine at a later date expressed this discomfort. So this is the same woman. For me, right, when I saw those Chuukyi's, I really, whoa, back up, right? I don't feel good when they translate it if I have something. I don't really want them to know my business. So that's why I don't want just whoa. I hear it. Some Chuukyi's, they don't like it too. They don't like Chuukyi's to know their business. They go and tell everybody, and then everybody knows. Even women with limited English skills were willing to go out of their way to avoid the Chuukyi's translators and go to the other clinic where they could then just not really communicate very well with the providers. Perceived lack of confidentiality is a less frequently discussed issue in the literature, but I imagine that it is common in rural communities. Yet avoidance of the clinics with ethnically similar employees is a very important, unique finding to be considered, given that the major recommendation of cultural and linguistically appropriate services is to hire more employees that culturally match the patients being served. There are other privacy concerns as well. The sense of privacy, especially as it relates to sexual and reproductive health topics, was a barrier in other ways beyond the Chuukyi's worker confidentiality issue. The stigma associated with the STD-HIV clinic, for example, prevented access to these much-needed services. Several interview participants specifically said they do know where the STD-HIV room is, and people don't want to be seen going in there by somebody they might run into at the clinic. Another private matter is the exposure of female genitals to anyone other than their partners. Many of these issues are relevant to patients seeking publicly funded care throughout the U.S. and abroad, such as transportation access, overburdened healthcare workers with more patients than time allows, and so forth. Further, familial obligations and feeling intimidated by the clinic process and healthcare providers themselves is not necessarily unique to Guam, but perhaps common for patients living in poverty who must seek healthcare in entrenched bureaucratic systems. Further, Chuukyi's patients are not alone in experiencing difficulty communicating with healthcare workers because of politeness, language, and intimidation, nor are they alone in feeling further marginalized by rushed, unfriendly healthcare workers. All of these findings draw on an important point that we must go beyond these ideas of cultural competency that create cultural categories of people and patients, and instead be creating environments in which respect is given to all patients, and the often similar, in terms of social class, socioeconomic status, lower-level clinic employees, who also feel disenfranchised in these hierarchical environments, then taking it out on patients. So treating Chuukyi's patients special to accommodate the yes factor and language access could be problematic, but allowing for new community-based staff to help with the system navigation to actually get into the clinic, allowing space for follow-up questions within the clinical encounter, providing patients with high-quality care and all the information that they need, and ensuring that all information is actually translated for all patients is a possibility that we could see in diverse clinical environments. Thank you.